Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, let's do it again. It's time to improve your American English skills. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we have two stories for you, presented at a slower speed and with words that are easy to understand. First, we have some interesting information about the economy of Indonesia. Some experts say the East Asian country will soon become a $1 trillion economy. We'll have details. Then we will tell you about something new from the world of art. It's a trip to the American West Coast to hear how some people are using something unusual to create special objects. Let's get started with part one. IHS Global Insight studies economic conditions around the world. The company believes that in 2 years, Indonesia will become Asia's latest $1 trillion economy. Its reason? A jump in the gross domestic product, or GDP, the total value of goods and services produced within a country. IHS Global Insight predicts that by 2023, Indonesia's GDP will double to $2 trillion. It also thinks Indonesia's GDP will rise to $3 trillion by 2028. The company expects Indonesia will have a larger gross domestic product than Russia by 2021. It says Indonesia's expanding middle class will make the country the largest market for consumer goods in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. IHS Global Insight Chief Economist Rajiv Biswas spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about Indonesian President Joko Widodo, also known as Jokowi. Mr. Biswas noted how the president launched a major program to improve his country's power supplies, roads, and other infrastructure.
That has been very much part of his election platform, and in his early months of office, it's clear that he has a strong focus on that. And that's something that Indonesia very much needs. Indonesia is one of the Asian economies that's relatively underdeveloped in terms of infrastructure.
Rajiv Biswas says the spending on ports, roads, and public services will help to fuel Indonesia's economic growth. The current growth rate is 5% a year, but it was about 6.5% a few years ago. Mr. Biswas says the government debt-to-GDP rate is low for Indonesia when compared to past rates. He says the former government did a very good job in reducing government debt levels. Early in his administration, President Joko Widodo announced cuts in government fuel subsidies. For years, the Indonesian government had used public spending to keep fuel prices low. The decision to cut subsidies was unpopular, but Rajiv Biswas says it helped the economy.
The fuel subsidy reform was very, very important because it was a heavy drain on their government expenditure in a rather unproductive form of just giving fuel subsidies to the entire population. They will also be able to divert a lot of that money that would have been spent on fuel subsidies towards infrastructure development, which is much more productive in the long term for the economy.
Rajiv Biswas says automobile sales have jumped over the past 5 to 7 years because of a rise in pay among Indonesia's middle class. He expects to see a pickup in auto sales if the economy can grow at a rate of 6 to 7% a year. He adds that Indonesia still rates low on the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business Index. He says the country needs to increase manufacturing exports
and create jobs. IHS Global Insight reports that more than 2 million young people are joining the Indonesian labor force each year. It says continued job growth is necessary to avoid the risk of social unrest. Yet, the company estimates total per-person GDP in Indonesia will rise from $3,400 this year to around $8,700 by 2025. It says this might give the Indonesian government a greater voice in international financial organizations, and possibly the group of five nations known as BRICS. The five are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Trash and garbage are other words for waste, things that people no longer want or need. In San Francisco, they are also words for art. A local recycling company called Recology created a program to give artists the opportunity to reuse unwanted objects. Artists are paid to work for 4 months on transforming things like old tires, toys, and paint. Marcia James is our tour guide.
Ma Lee is one of the artists at the center. She is working on a project that includes plastic bottles, cardboard tubes, and cloth. Ma Lee is turning them into a moving sculpture with stars, flowing air, and dancers. Miss Lee says she learned recycling from her parents while growing up in China in the 1980s. It was a time when the country was poorer and more concerned about saving money than it is today. San Francisco artist Michael Arcega works with recycled wood and old leather belts, all saved from the garbage.
My project is based on pseudo-anthropological research on the people of the Nasirima.
Michael Arcega explains that Nasirima is American spelled backwards. His artwork shows what he says is the wasteful culture of the American people. Still, he says, looking through the trash is not easy. It is hard to separate what is useful and what is really garbage. A gallery in Los Angeles is displaying some of the art from the San Francisco project. The show includes pictures made from pieces of labels, sculptures from old metal, and saws that have been cut to look like trees. Each year, more than 5,000 children and adults visit shows created by the artists. They also attend educational tours that allow the public to talk to the artists and learn important lessons about recycling. Los Angeles gallery owner Liz Gordon says artists have a history of recycling.
People who didn't have the resources to be able to go out and buy supplies found supplies and have been using found object and assemblage for many, many years.
Artist Ma Lee says these artworks have a message.
So everyone can come together to actually make little change in their daily life and behavior to actually try to save the environment and resource.
Mike Sanjacomo heads the recycling company. He says he hopes to see as much waste as possible reused.
Along the way, if some of it made into these fun pieces of art, and draws people's attention to the issue, we think it's a great way to do something that's good for our business, good for our community, good for society.
And the project shows how a little imagination can change one person's trash into another's artwork. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English. English learners have difficulty with gerunds and infinitives. A gerund is the ing form of a verb that functions the same as a noun. For example, running is fun. In this sentence, running is the gerund. It acts just like a noun.
The infinitive form of a verb appears either as the basic form with no marking or with the word to. For example, you can say, I might run to the store, or I like to run. In this sentence, to run is the infinitive.
It is difficult for English learners to know whether to use a gerund or an infinitive after a verb. Here's an example. Which sentence is correct? Sentence 1. I suggested going to dinner. Sentence 2. I suggested to go to dinner. Sentence 1 with the gerund is correct. I suggested going to dinner. Why? You can only use a gerund after the verb suggest.
Let's take the word like. You can say, I like running. Or, I like to run. Both sentences have the same meaning. You can use either a gerund or an infinitive after like. Now let's try enjoy. We can say, I enjoy running. But we cannot say, I enjoy to run. Why? Only a gerund can follow the verb enjoy.
Are you confused yet? You're not alone. Gerunds and infinitives confuse even very advanced English learners. Basically, some verbs are followed by gerunds, some verbs are followed by infinitives, and some verbs can be followed by gerunds or infinitives. Native speakers do not think about the difference. But English learners have to memorize the hundreds of different verb combinations.
Here are a few tips. Tip number one. You almost always find a gerund after a preposition. For example, she is afraid of flying. In this sentence, of is the preposition, and flying is the gerund. You cannot say, she is afraid of to fly. An infinitive cannot be the object of a preposition. Only a gerund can. You could say, she is afraid to fly. But in this sentence, the preposition of is gone.
Tip number two. When you are talking about an activity, you usually use a gerund. For example, I stopped smoking. You can describe many activities by using go before a gerund. Let's go shopping, or we went skiing. There is no quick and easy way to learn gerunds and infinitives. It takes years of practice with the English language. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, Bob Doty and I discuss American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. Hard economic times and social conflict have always offered a rich source of material for artists and writers. A painter's colors can show the drying of dreams or the flight of the human spirit. A musician can express the tensions and uncertainty of a people in struggle. The pressures of hard times can be the force to lift a writer's imagination to new heights. So it was during the 1930s in the United States. The severe economic crisis, the Great Depression, created an atmosphere for artistic imagination and creative expression. The common feeling of struggle also led millions of Americans to look to films, radio, and other new art forms for relief from their day-to-day cares.
The most popular sound of the 1930s was a new kind of music, swing music. And the king of swing was a clarinet player named Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman and other musicians made swing music extremely popular during the 1930s. Swing music was a new form of jazz. Many of its first players were black musicians in small, unknown groups. It was only when more well-known white musicians started playing swing music in the middle 1930s that the new music became wildly popular.
One reason for the popularity of swing music was the growing power of radio during the 1930s. Radio had already proven in earlier years that it could be an important force in both politics and popular culture. Millions of Americans bought radios during the 1920s. But radio grew up in the 1930s. Producers became more skillful in creating programs. And actors and actresses began to understand the special needs and power of this new electronic art form. Swing music was not the only kind of music that radio helped make popular. The 1930s also saw increasing popularity for traditional classical music by Beethoven, Bach, and other great musicians. In 1930, the Columbia Broadcasting System began a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra on Sunday afternoons. The next year, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, began weekly opera concerts.
In 1937, NBC asked Arturo Toscanini of Italy to lead an orchestra on American radio. Toscanini was the greatest orchestra leader of his day. Millions of Americans listened at Christmas time, As Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra began playing the first of 10 special radio concerts. It was a great moment for both music and radio. For the first time, millions of average Americans were able to hear classical music by great musicians as it was being played.
Music was an important reason why millions of Americans gathered to listen to the radio during the 1930s. But even more popular were a series of weekly programs with exciting or funny new actors. Families would come home from school or work and laugh at the foolish experiences of such actors as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields. Radio helped people forget the hard conditions of the Great Depression, and it helped to bring Americans together and share experiences.
Swing music, classical music, great comedy programs. The 1930s truly were a golden period for radio and mass communications. But it was also during this period that Hollywood and the American film industry became much more skilled and influential. In previous years, films were silent, but the talkies arrived in the 1930s.
Directors could produce films in which actors could talk. Americans reacted by attending film theaters by the millions. It was a great time for Hollywood. The films had exciting new actors. Spencer Tracy, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, the young Shirley Temple. The most famous film of the period was Gone with the Wind, with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the starring roles of Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you're the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
Directors in the 1930s also produced such great films as It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and The Life of Emile Zola.
The success of radio and films, as well as the Depression itself, caused problems for many American newspapers during the 1930s. The trouble was not so much that readers stopped buying newspapers. It was that companies talked about their products through advertisements on radio instead of buying advertising space in newspapers. Nearly half of the nation's independently published newspapers either stopped publishing or joined larger companies during the 1930s. By World War II, only 120 cities had competing newspapers.
Weekly and monthly publications faced the same problem as daily newspapers: increased competition from radio and films. Many magazines failed. The two big successes of the period were Life magazine and the Reader's Digest. Life magazine had stories for everyone about film actors, news events, or just daily life in the home or on the farm. Its photographs were the greatest anywhere. Reader's Digest published shorter forms of stories from other magazines and sources.
Most popular books of the period were like the films coming from Hollywood. Writers cared more about helping people forget their troubles than about facing serious social issues. They made more money that way, too. But A number of writers in the 1930s did produce books that were both profitable and of high quality. One was Sinclair Lewis. His book, It Can't Happen Here, warned of the coming dangers of fascism. John Steinbeck's great book, The Grapes of Wrath, helped millions understand and feel in their hearts the troubles faced by poor farmers. Erskine Caldwell wrote about the cruelty of life among poor people in the southeastern United States, and James T. Farrell about life in Chicago.
The same social concern and desire to present life as it really existed also were clear in the work of many American artists during the 1930s. Thomas Benton painted workers and others with strong, tough bodies. Edward Hopper showed the sad streets of American cities. Reginald Marsh painted picture after picture of poor parts of New York City. The federal government created a program that gave jobs to artists. They painted their pictures on the walls of airports, post offices, and schools. The program brought their ideas and creativity to millions of people. At the same time, photography became more important as cameras improved in quality and became more movable. Some photographers, like Margaret Burke White and Walker Evans, used their cameras to report the hard conditions of the Depression.
All this activity in the arts and popular culture played an important part in the lives of Americans during the 1930s. It not only provided relief from their troubles, but expanded their minds and pushed their imaginations. The tensions and troubles of the Great Depression provided a rich atmosphere for artists and others to produce works that were serious, foolish, or just plain fun. And those works, in turn, helped make life a little better as Americans waited, worked, and hoped for times to improve.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. I'm Steve Ember with Bob Doty. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.